This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Hello, it's a musical edition of the Hope Mornings weekly podcast today. I would change the world. I would be the sunlight in your universe. And you would think my love was really something good, baby, if I could. You know that I'd change it. Joining me in this episode is Steve Clisby from the 2013 season of The Voice. He may have been the oldest contestant in last year's season, but that didn't stop the season performer from achieving his dreams of reaching a wider audience in Australia. Ooh, ooh, I'm searching for a better land, heaven. If you were born in the 80s, the 70s, or perhaps a little bit earlier, you probably also remember the Eurogliders, like In Excess and Crowded House. They were one of only a handful of Aussie bands to achieve success in the US in the 1980s. Bernie Lynch from Eurogliders remembers life at the peak of their fame ahead of their Sydney shows this weekend. We talk technology. Colette Smart from Family Smart shares the latest info showing that placing limits on teens' access to technology pays big dividends. And Andrew Morris explains the concept of planned obsolescence, as a Harvard study implies that Apple may be deliberately slowing down old iPhones just ahead of the release of a new model. Joanna Hayes from Celibate in the City examines TV couples and asks whether popular television provides any examples of healthy relationships. She even takes on Australia's favourite, if slightly neurotic, obstetrician, the much-loved Nina Proudman from Offspring. And the Archibald Prize exhibition is on in Sydney, featuring a host of all non-identities and some colourful artists. Shona White from the Art Gallery of New South Wales shares this year's highlights. I'm Katrina Rowe, and thanks for listening to the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. How could we ever forget Steve Clisby, one of the finalists from The Voice 2013? Well, a year later, his new album is coming out soon and he's about to embark on a national tour, including a Sydney show. Steve Clisby is on the line. Great to speak to you, Steve.
It's great to speak to you.
Now, you've been in the music industry a long time, and I imagine that some of your mates in the music industry might have been a bit surprised by your decision to go on The Voice. Are you glad that you did it?
Very pleased. I thought it was going to be a bit of a chance, but I've always been sort of a chance taker without really realizing it, you know. It's just that I get an idea, and then I think I've got to follow through, and don't think too much about the consequences. Although I have to admit I was thinking about consequences in this case, but there's no way to predict what would happen.
Why did you really decide to go on it? What were you hoping to get out of it?
Well, I wanted more people to, in one hit, to be able to see what I was doing. Been playing for a long time, and we've done lots and lots of shows, and there's always been a really great reaction. But to broaden the audience and the base, you know, I didn't want to do a program that I didn't think had integrity. So not just for the hell of it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
This program seemed to have a really strong musical component. Seemed to be respectful of the musicians, and particularly revolved around The Voice. So I thought that was, you know, it's right up my alley.
Yeah. And what did it actually give you in the end, Steve? What did you get out of The Voice?
Well, I got a lot out of it. I mean, I made a lot of really great friends. I learned a hell of a lot about letting go of sort of control of everything, because I've been quite used to being in total control of my career and what I sing, and including what I look like. I didn't have much collaboration with other people. It was always me making the decisions about what I did. And I think there's always a chance when you're, you know, sort of got entrepreneurial spirit, then you want to manage things yourself, you know.
Yeah.
and part of the key to success is being able to let go of that.
Well, I wanted to ask you, was it hard for you to almost submit to a coach who has less experience than you do?
I mean, it's a bit ageist in saying that.
Yeah.
Except in reverse. So in other words, you know, you're saying, well, I don't have anything to learn from a younger person. But in fact, you know, we learn from our kids. When I went into the studio when we recorded the album, I was working with someone that's, you know, well, most of the time I'm working with people that are younger than I am. So I got to listen to somebody. So with Delta, it was the same. I think she's been in the business for a long time. So, and she's been in a part of the business that I haven't been in. as much. I mean, I've been in the live, you know, touring, making records and coaching people and doing all that. But she's been as a child star and TV, and from a young kid, she's been doing that. So it's a completely different perspective. And she's also Australian, which I thought was very helpful in helping me to understand Australian audience and what they like and what they want.
Yeah, well, you're now actually an Aussie, aren't you? Since last year, you've become an Australian citizen. Yeah.
Oh, I don't need any help anymore with that.
But, Steve, what actually brought you here? Because for someone in your style of music and everything like that, that our audience is a lot smaller, really, than, say, the United States or Europe. So what brought you to Australia, and what's kept you here?
I was just tired. I was tired of Northern Europe, basically. That's the way it was. I mean, we toured. We'd done pretty much everything that I could do. And I thought I need to get back to the sun. I want to go to.
A warm place.
Really, yeah. Honestly, that was really, you know, one of my major motivations. I was like, I need to get back to the sun. Mm. You know, I need some vitamin D.
I understand that. Yep.
I need to get the juices flowing, and maybe I can still be creative. So I just kind of got a new lease on life once I got here. Met some really great people, and musically it was exciting.
Now, you've worked and toured with a lot of big name artists in your time, and I wanted to ask you, who's taught you the most, or who's really inspired you in your music?
That's a good question. My initial inspiration comes from jazz, mostly pop jazz, to tell you the truth. So some of the artists that I really loved was like Nina Simone. Of course, I was inspired by John Coltrane and Jimi Hendrix. And, you know, those were my initial idols. I love, you know, Stevie Wonder, of course. I went to a Stevie Wonder concert. I took a date, and he started playing it was Happier Than the Morning Sun, one of the songs off Talking Book, and I just literally broke down sobbing like a kid, you know. I mean, it was kind of embarrassing because I could, but I mean, I cried like a baby. It was just, he just stabbed me in the heart with it. It was just too amazing. I love Stevie and what he brought to his inspiration. And I love a lot of gospel music as well.
So tell us about your new album. What can people expect from that?
Well, the album is called Leave Me Dreaming. It's upbeat and energetic. I think it's got some things in it that people wouldn't necessarily expect from me. And I think that's a good thing. We've done some unique versions of songs that you may already know, and my hope is that you're going to like my versions better than the originals.
Are there some original songs on there as well, Steve?
There are a couple of original songs, and there are some songs that I've found that were previously unreleased by other artists. So the title track, Leave Me Dreaming, is one of those, and I just absolutely love it. It's been carrying that song around for about 4 months, and finally we got to record it, and it's just... I'm in love. I was in love with it and still am. So,
okay.
And I'm walking these streets as well. So I'm just really looking forward to getting out and playing the album live and letting people hear it.
Well, speaking of dreaming, Steve, look, I'm not calling you old, but but you are an example. But you are an example.
Oh my God, that's a loaded statement.
Oh, totally, totally, totally. Look, you are an example that it's never too late to achieve your dreams. And I think a lot of people would get into their 60s and think, well, I didn't do that thing that I wanted to do. You know, I never made that happen. I mean, how do you feel about that as sort of being an inspiration to people of your similar age that actually get out there and make it happen?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping that that's the case. However, I try not to let my chronological age be a barrier. So, I mean, I think once you psych yourself into thinking that because I am a certain age, I think you're only as old as you think. And, of course, you know, there's some practical things to take into consideration. I mean, you've got to, you know, try to keep yourself fit and what have you. But I think, you know, I'm pretty vain, so I like... I refuse, you know, like, I don't want to gain weight and all that stuff. I just want to, you know, I want to stay as youthful as I can. I'm pleased that I think that way. My mom is pretty much the same way, you know. And I do think, really, a lot of it is just between your ears, you know. And the other thing is that people are, these days, they're living longer, and you know, 60 is the new 40, and, you know.
Well, look, I'm about to turn 40, so I'm hoping that 40 is the new 20.
Yeah, well, 40 can be the new 40, can be the new 20. That's it. I mean, it is really like that. I mean, it's certainly not like it used to be. I mean, most of the time, if you were lucky if you got into your 60s.
Now you can start your third career.
That's what I'm That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, thank you, Steve. It's been lovely to catch up with you. I'm glad to hear you're doing big things.
Trying my best.
Great to catch up with you. Steve Clisby, he is performing at the Oxford Art Factory in Sydney on Wednesday, September the 3rd. This is the new single, Walking These Streets. Thanks, Steve.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Been walking these streets so long, 'cause I need somebody else. Been treating my love so wrong, 'cause I need somebody else. The pleasure and pain you bring to me, you got me down my knees. I'm begging you please, no more sorrow and pain. It's all I see. Now it don't matter no thing, 'cause it's gonna be alright. Somebody else been treating my love so wrong, 'cause I need somebody else. The pleasure and pain you gave to me, you got me down on my knees. I'm begging you please, no more sorrow and pain is all I see. Now it don't matter no thing, 'cause it's gonna be so long, 'cause I need somebody else. Been treating my love so wrong, 'cause I need somebody else. Working for your money every night and day, 'cause I'm a good man, I'm a good, good man. Once it was your loving was the only way. Spend my heart and soul for you.
Hope 1032 Mornings, Rugrats, Relatives and Relationships.
A few years ago, the most common cyber safety advice given to parents was to keep computers out of the bedroom and to have them in a shared public space. But in just a few short years, that advice has become largely irrelevant. Now there are so many devices in the home, tablets, smartphones and laptops, that there are many occasions when tweens and teens can be on the internet without you even knowing about it. So how can parents keep their children's technology use under control? Colette Smart from Family Smart is on the line. G'day, Colette.
Hello, Katrina.
Now, this new survey of 1,000 tweens and teens has found that 70% of kids 8 to 17 said their parents did not know about their online activities. Are kids deliberately concealing some of their online activities from their parents?
Well, it seems like what the survey says is that is the case. 83% of the young people surveyed said they really respect their parents' guidance and guideline, but yet 90% said their parents trusted them. Yet then they went on to say that they believe their parents are oblivious to their web activities and what's going on. They set up fake social media profiles. They delete browser histories. They attempted to hide their online deeds of their parents. Mm. So I think there's a lot of stuff going on there with teens that I think parents are oblivious to, or just hope their kids are doing the right thing and not actively being involved to see what's going on.
Do you think, though, now that families have so many different devices, is it even possible for parents to really keep tabs on what their kids are doing?
Yes, I do. I think we're quick to say, oh, you know, there's too many devices, it's too difficult. I think we need to remember that the majority of our young people, our younger teens and our young children, are at home for a lot of the time in their day or at school. They don't trawl the malls on their own. You won't find 10-year-olds waltzing around the malls or coffee shops finding hotspots on their own. So I still think parents need to be vigilant. Technology has to be out of bedrooms, particularly at night. We're pretty strict with our boundaries at home, so our children can play all those devices, but they're in the lounge room, in the kitchen. You know, we're not restricting the access to those devices, but when they're at home, they need to be in spaces where there's traffic and people are still around.
And what are some of the positive benefits of putting limits on technology, Colette?
Well, I think, you know, parents often wonder, it feels so hard. It feels so difficult. And I can tell you I know what that's like. I have three kids and it feels constant. But we need to be encouraged that there's a survey that's come out that if we wonder if it's worth it, the survey is saying, yes, it is worth it. The study in America has actually shown that when we put limits on content that children use or content that they access, as well as limits on the time, the amount of time that they spend with entertainment screen time, we're actually seeing some amazing benefits that are popping up in the long term, not just overnight. What all this hard work we're doing is actually worth it.
Okay, so I guess that's a bit of encouragement to parents that even if it feels exhausting and difficult, the benefits do pay off.
Yet, so limiting, now when I say limiting, it doesn't mean banning all technology. You know, we've got iPads, iPod, DSs and Xbox, iPhones in our house. I could go on. We are still the parents and we are allowed to say no to what our children access, the type of apps they put up. Obviously, children are children and they will make devious decisions sometimes, but it's our job as parents to be continually talking and just making sure we're aware of what they're accessing. Two of the immediate effects that we saw on placing limits on media that the study showed is, number one, the children spend less time with TV and video games. In other words, they are doing sport and socializing, eating at the table with their parents, that kind of thing. Children also saw less violent media, which is obvious because they spent less time watching TV, so they saw less violent content. However, it's the long-term effects that are so fantastic.
Okay.
What they saw after 7 months of parents limiting the time that their children spent with media, entertainment media, is these children were now getting more sleep, they were getting better grades at school, and the more sleep led to something they didn't expect. Children now had a better body mass than children who had spent more time sitting in front of a screen simply because they were moving around more. Then the long-term benefits after 7 months of parents limiting the type of content, for example, not allowing a lot of violent media exposure, these children had increased pro-social behavior, so they were exhibiting more helpful, cooperative pro-social behaviors at school, and they were less aggressive towards their peers.
Yeah, yeah, I can totally see how that would rub off. All right, well, thank you, Colette, for some great advice there.
That's a pleasure.
Yeah, that's Colette Smart from Family Smart. You can find her online at familysmart.com.au. Still to come on the Hope Mornings Weekly podcast, we catch up with Bernie Lynch, one half of 80s sensation Eurogliders. We talk TV couples with Joanna Hayes from Celibate in the City and an insider's view of the Archibald Prize.
Hope 103.2 Mornings with Katrina Rowe.
The Culture Collective.
It's one of the best movies I've seen for ages.
Really fun series, but it's got a great underlying message.
Guaranteed 8 out of 10.
Have you ever noticed how often something breaks just after the warranty has expired. Or have you ever been frustrated when a website will only function with the latest version of a particular browser, only to find out that the new browser isn't compatible with your old computer? How much more frustrating is it when you realise that these problems were created deliberately as a form of planned obsolescence? A new Harvard study suggests Apple may be deliberately slowing down old iPhones before the release of a new one. Andrew Morris, our new media manager, is here to explain how planned obsolescence works. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Katrina. It's fascinating, isn't it? There was a recent documentary on planned obsolescence and how it sort of came out of the Great Depression. The US was wanting to stimulate the economy, and so they started creating products and saying businesses should start creating new versions of products and create that desire to have a new updated version of something. So it traces back to the 20s.
Wow.
And we can talk about some classic examples of things, but the iPhone story from Harvard is suggesting that there's a lot of chatter online when a new Apple product is announced or released, and that people are saying, oh, my iPhone's really slow. Where there's no proof that Apple or other manufacturers are doing that to smartphones and stuff.
It was interesting, though, that the Samsung Galaxy didn't have that same issue.
Yeah, I mean, I can't explain that, but I mean, the Harvard economics professor, Sentil, does talk about how over time your phone collects a lot of garbage, old files, like a computer when you defrag it and stuff, that the phone becomes quite congested with old data and material like that. And every time you add a new app, apps and software are always improved, demanding more hard drive space or more RAM. And so the new software that Apple releases is more intense. It requires more of your phone's processing power. They also update old phones with that new version as well. So you're using a new software on an old phone. So, I mean, yes, we can see, and we're going to talk about it, planned obsolescence is definitely in most of the products we buy. But, and this is a could-be, but there are some logical reasons why it also happens.
And so what are some more obvious examples of planned obsolescence?
Well, the funny that you say, nylon stockings. Every lady that's worn stockings knows that they ladder the first or second time that you put them on.
Always. Such a waste of money. I know.
But we haven't designed a better material to use. And so they know that you're going to come back and buy more stockings after more stockings.
It's ridiculous.
But the classic is the Phoebus cartel in the 20s, which was discovered. Now, this is a group of light bulb manufacturers, likes of Osram, Philips, General Electric. Back in the... They had a pact in the 20s to say, okay, we want our incandescent light bulbs. They could go for, say, 1,500 or 2,000 hours. But we agree as a group that we're going to limit the length, the lifespan of a light bulb to 1,000 hours.
Okay, wow.
And they were discovered, a Swiss company came in, and this is where competition does play a part, made the light bulbs last longer. And so they, you know, there was competition coming to... When there's competition, there's less likelihood that businesses will create products that have a deliberate obsolescence in them because, you know, they've got other competitors in the marketplaces. But if you're one or two businesses, then there's more chance that you could control that market and the length of a product.
Okay, now we hear a lot about this with cars as well.
Yeah, cars, a classic. So Ford created the first motor vehicle, and it was available in black. Then General Motors said, hey, we should have cars every year. You should be able to buy a new car every year. So they came out with all different colours and designs and, with the idea that you'll just... the desirability. So there's this psychological obsolescence where businesses say, you know, they put new features, make a product more fancy and sexy and thinking that, oh, I'm missing out if I don't have that new product. So that's a psychological obsolescence.
Well, you've only got to look at that pair of jeans in the back of the cupboard that nobody ever wears because it's out of style.
Fashion is a classic obsolescence. There's a fashion cycle. It comes in, it goes out. They want you to buy the next season's fashion. That's a classic obsolescence thing. The other is functional. And this is things like when they've built printers, they've got a little ticking chip inside it that says that even if the ink cartridge is not empty, it will stop printing after so many prints.
Wow.
So there's still ink. You could still get more life out of that ink cartridge.
That's evil.
But they've put chips or they've put some kind of counter device in the printer that will stop, that will indicate that the ink cartridge is empty when it's not not really empty at all.
Okay. Well, look, there has to be an environmental cost to this, particularly with something like ink cartridges, which are made out of, petroleum. It's so good for the environment, right?
Well, no. Yes, you can see that there is massive wastage. And businesses, you know, do try to predict and through through lots of calculations to figure out how many products they're going to sell of this, you know, how many products they're going to ship and sell. But often the case, if they're releasing products very quickly year after year, they're going to have a lot of stock that's never opened, never seen the light of day, which they will dispose of. More and more is being recycled, but there is an environmental cost to this. We can't just keep incurring growth. The other thing is that from a marketing and economics perspective, that it does encourage innovation and design, and it does help growth and the economic world continue to turn around and change.
Yeah. Well, surely it must create new markets if everyone else is making stuff that breaks, if a company could make something that lasts, that could be a competitive advantage.
Yeah, that is true. That's true. But, you know, next time you say, oh, my fridge doesn't last as long as it used to, the old one, well, that's probably true because they use cheaper parts because we want to buy them at a cheaper price.
Yeah, oh, that's true, yes. All right, well, Andrew, thanks for filling us in. I'm not totally convinced about the iPhone. I think there could be something sus going on there.
You never know.
It's Andrew Morris. We've been talking about planned obsolescence. We all have our favourite TV couples, whether it was Nina and Patrick on Offspring, Mary and Matthew on Downton Abbey, or Lily and Marshall on How I Met Your Mother, or of course the classic Ross and Rachel on Friends. On some level, we watch these characters because we all hope to find that special someone who really understands us. But what do we actually learn from TV couples? Can they actually be a good role model for relationships? Joanna Hayes is on the line from Celibate in the City. G'day, Joanna.
Good morning.
Now, what are some of the kind of typical types of relationships that we see on TV?
Well, I think definitely there's the classic, this guy is a doofus. Model, most commonly found on sitcoms.
Uh-huh.
So I think the current is Phil and Claire Dunphy on Modern Family.
Mm.
He's just a dweeb and constantly gets everything wrong and thinks he's hilarious and thinks he's really smart. And it's just a classic setup, you know.
He's kind of like really the man child, isn't he? Like, you know, he hasn't quite grown up. The kid she's married to, yeah.
Exactly. So, but it's a staple, particularly of American sitcoms. So everybody loves Raymond, and pretty much any current American sitcom, the guy is usually a twit. And that's where the comedy is drawn from. So not a great model of relationships.
No.
Particularly for guys who I presume are slightly offended by being portrayed as kind of drooling Neanderthals.
Yeah, that's a worry, isn't it? That's not the best role model.
Yeah.
Are there others that you sort of stumble up against again?
Well, I despair from the female perspective because the role models there are pretty hopeless as well. And I am going to do it, Katrina. I'm going to attack everyone's favourite, Nina from Offspring.
Oh, but I am Nina.
Can the woman get a relationship right? I mean, honestly.
It's not her fault, Joe. Have you seen her parents? I mean, they're hopeless.
Have you seen every married guy she's dated? So I think that's another pretty classic example as well. So, like, the woman, she just wants to get it right. She just wants someone to love her, and she keeps, you know, pursuing relationships with duds. Even the successful ones aren't actually that great.
Well, I think, look, in Nina's defence, I think there's going to be an explanation with Thomas. I don't think we can do. I think we'll find out tonight that it's not all as it appears.
Look, that's as may be. But I think, again, it's a pretty classic TV stereotype, movie stereotype. The woman who just wants to be loved.
So she's...
And there's so much complication, but passion and difficulty in the relationship that, oh, what's going to happen?
Well, that's true. And she's always, like, completely competent in the other areas of her life, like at work, but in love she's just completely useless.
Yeah, how is it that she can't figure this out?
That's true.
So I think it's pretty natural that we look for role models, but I think unfortunately TV doesn't really hold that many great examples for us.
Is there actually an example of a healthy relationship on TV?
Well, I'm pretty classic old school, and I know that some of your listeners will join me in loving Gene and Lionel from As Time Goes By, which is very classically old school. When I think about TV shows that I watch at the moment, I can't actually think of a relationship that I would aspire to.
I've got one. Marshall and Lily on How I Met Your Mother.
Okay.
Or Leslie and Ben on Parks and Recreation. Come on, they're adorable. Have you ever seen that show?
Okay, they are adorable. But, I think, it's interesting, though, just the difficulties of finding a good relationship on TV. I guess there's just not as much drama or ratings in a successful relationship.
Yeah, but I wonder if this is rubbing off. Do you think we need healthy relationship role models on TV and, I guess, in real life?
Oh, absolutely. We naturally look for role models anyway. I think for a lot of us, our first role models in relationships are our parents. And many of us are blessed to have great examples in that area. Mm. But for some of us, it's not really the pattern we want to follow. But I think we do naturally look for examples. So, yeah, I wish that there were better relationships on TV, but I'm really thankful that, at least in my life, I'm blessed with the opportunity to observe quite a few relationships that I would love to emulate. And particularly some older Christian couples and just the way that they love each other, the way that they've raised their kids. If I ever get called into marriage, I think I'd love, to imitate them. And also, even as a single person, particularly when I moved to Sydney, I was so glad to come across some fantastic examples of single Christian women in ministry and in life. And just, it was so wonderful to be like, okay, this is what it could be like. This is how it could be, just in a really positive way. And there are many women I know who I aspire to be like, which has been a huge encouragement. Not so much Nina.
Joe, does this mean that I have to give up offspring? Because I love Nina. I love her like a sister.
Oh, look, it's fine to keep watching. I'm not saying you shouldn't. But maybe we need to look elsewhere for good relationship role models.
And I just need to maybe monitor my internal monologue and just make sure it's not too Nina-ish as well.
Well, you're already on Tom's side, which I think is interesting.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
That's a pleasure.
Joanna Hayes from the blog celibateinthecity.net. We've been talking about TV couples. Well, the Archibald Prize is on again. It's one of those exhibitions that really brings art to the masses. Shona White is the head of public programs at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. Hi, Shona.
Oh, hi there.
Now, let's start with the winner this year, Fiona Lowry's portrait of Penelope Seidler. What makes this painting so special?
It's a fascinating portrait, this one, and it's interesting how everyone is really warmed to it, that is the critics and also the general public. I think the sitter is a great choice of sitter. Penelope Seidler is a really interesting woman with a great personality, and she just looks amazing. And we're sort of seeing her in a way that you wouldn't normally see her. She's an architect, and she's certainly been around, involved in the arts and certainly civic matters for a long time. But we're sort of seeing her caught in an unguarded moment, and it's all depicted very, very softly. The use of paint that Fiona uses is actually a little tiny fine airbrush. So in fact, she doesn't even touch the canvas.
Yeah.
It's kind of whispered on in a way. There's just these mists of paint. So it's soft and it's ghostly, and yet at the same time it's got this fantastic clarity in the face and a sort of sense of this woman gazing up. It looks quite intense.
Yeah, people who go to the Archibalds every year will remember her paintings from the past. Last year I think she was the runner-up, wasn't she?
That's right, and that was also in this very particular style that she had, although that one was a brighter colour. This one's got very sort of smoky, nondescript sort of monotone. I think that was a beautiful portrait too, like very, very interesting.
Yeah, the airbrush style really stands out. Now, people also love seeing, of course, the paintings of the famous faces that they know. Who are some of the well-known identities that feature in this year's exhibition?
Well, Cate Blanchett is probably, one of the biggest known people, but then it's also interesting that we've got Adam Goodes, the Australian of the Year, and he's also a Swans footballer for rugby league fans. There's Fui Fui Moi Moi, who's got a very strong portrait in this year as well, and Anna Mears, who's just been racing for Australia in the Commonwealth Games. So there's those sort of sporting figures as well, which is interesting this year.
Yeah.
But also, you know, actors and artists and, you know, a whole bunch of people.
And a good representation of Indigenous Australians with Adam Goods and Archie Roach, just to name a couple off the top of my head.
Dan Fulton and an artist, another artist there too as well.
Okay. Now, there's also always a lot of interest in the painting that wins the Packing Room Prize. And this year it was this hyper-realist portrait of Sir Les Paterson. Can you tell us a bit about that one?
Yes, well, that was painted by Tim Storia, who won the main prize a couple of years ago, and he has a very, very fine, delicate, detailed style. His painting style is extremely detailed. And Tim has done Barry Humphreys as Les Paterson. We've also got Barry Humphreys in the exhibition as well, but as himself. But in this case, he's done him as Les Paterson, who I thought had been retired, but he's obviously come out of retirement just for this portrait. And it is probably as grotesque as you could ever remember Les being. I mean, there's food all over him, and he's looking very awry. He's looking very messy, and he's looking particularly unappealing, actually.
Yeah, it's sort of more funny, confronting, because it is so sort of sharp and vivid, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's sort of more in your face.
Every single detail, every crumb that's been dropped down that, you know, chubby tummy is all sitting there on display.
Now, another surprise in there, well, at least for me, was seeing that the comedian Arndt is not one of the subjects, but is one of the painters. So he's done sort of an almost Ben Quilty-looking picture of his father. Has Arndt been an artist for a while, has he?
I think he's always had an interest in it, but it's only been recently that he's been picking it up. And I noticed that not only is he a finalist in the Archibald this year here, but he's also, I think he won a prize, a Rockdale Art Prize, recently as well with a different portrait.
Wow.
But, what a Renaissance man. He is obviously incredibly talented. Not only is he a great comedian and performer, but he's also taken up painting and this sort of really interesting, you know, thick impasto style. And he's doing very well with it.
Oh, I'm just shocked, because he's also a writer. He's written children's books.
That's
written biography.
Yes,
the man is just multi-talented. I think, you know, he's got to hold back for a while. Let someone else have a go.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
No, I'm sure people will be very interested to see his painting. Well, thank you for telling us a little bit about the Archibalds this morning, Shona. Great to chat with you.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Shona White. She's the head of public programs at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And we've been talking about the Archibald Prize exhibition. Along with bands like INXS and Crowded House, Euroglide is one of the few Aussie acts to really make it big in the US in the 80s. It was the combination of Grace Knight and Bernie Lynch that worked so well together. I caught up with Bernie Lynch ahead of their Sydney shows and asked him how the two met.
Well, where do I begin with that? Because, you know, we ended up getting married, so our meeting was really quite a funny old event. She came out here on a boat. And she was performing on the boat and landed in Fremantle in Perth, where her sister lived, and she basically jumped ship. So she decided to stay. And I knew her sister, and so one thing led to another, basically. She started playing in another band, I was playing in another band, and in order to get a date with her, I suggested that she come and sing on one of my records.
That was very sneaky, wasn't it?
Very sneaky.
And little did you know what it would lead to.
Well, indeed. It was what I hoped would have led to it, but anyway, that was how it all began. She came and sang and ended up leaving her band and joining mine and took over the role of being lead singer.
Did you fall in love with her voice before you fell in love with her?
No, it was definitely her.
Okay.
I knew that she could sing. There was no problem about that. But she was also a very lovely person too.
So take us back to the 80s when you were kind of living the dream at the peak of your success. What was life like for you then?
Look, it was a whirlwind, really. It was 24/7, basically, getting onto planes, driving long distances, particularly in Australia, driving long distances, although it ended up being the same over in America in particular. A lot of driving, and the most exciting thing of the day, really, was that 2 hours on stage. moving from one town to the next, it was about 2 hours every day that made the rest of it seem worthwhile. But it was hectic.
And what do you love about being on stage?
Look, you know, none of us ever got stage fright or anything, so it really was an interaction with the audience. And I think that's one of the things why people, for instance, like Grace Knight as a performer and as a singer, because she interacts with the audience. I mean, we don't just sing songs. I think these days we actually sing memories for people, because people remember the days when they used to come along and see Eurogliders or used to see us on TV, and they remember the sorts of excitement and fun that they had back then, and they begin to relive it again as they see us these days.
If there was a moment that you would like to relive, you know, what was one of the moments that you'll never forget from those heady days?
Good gracious. You know, having said that we don't get stage fright, I think it probably is the scariest moment of our life when we played in America for MTV on a New Year's Eve show in front of about 60 million people. And we were up there for probably only 5 minutes, but it was the most hair-raising and yet the most exciting thing I think that we ever did, because it was so nerve-wracking. And I think we played the song Heaven, and we played it about twice as fast as we were supposed to play it. And it sounded, in hindsight, appalling, but it was pretty exciting, I guess, being in New York and playing in front of that number of people.
That is awesome. Now, how does it work with you and Grace? Like, do you write together? Do you just jam? How do the songs come about?
Well, I'm a bit of an autocrat, I'm afraid, Katrina,
yeah,
in that I write all the songs and basically just present them. So it's been that way, you know, ever since day one of Eurogliders. But Grace and I have this understanding. She knows that if I write a song, it's a song that she can sing, because our voices are very similar. We sing together a lot on stage, and often people confuse on our CDs who it is singing. Sometimes it might be Grace singing, but it can sound a bit like me in the reverse. But the songs get written in the privacy of my life, and then I present them to Grace and we sit down and workshop them, and she sings them with her own character.
Yeah, it sounds like you've had a really great friendship. What's made your relationship so good for all this time?
Look, I think it was forged pretty much by the close contact that we had for so many years on the road. You know, there was a period there where Grace had her child, Jackie, who's like about 25 now, and he used to come on the road with us. And even though Grace and I weren't together at this stage, you know, we used to share responsibility for this child, and, you know, he would come in and stay in my room two or three times a week so that she could get a bit of a break. And you were talking about a child who's about 18 months old.
Yeah.
So, you know, it goes back a long way. We have a lot of trust between each other, and I think we both realise just how much we enjoy the industry itself. I mean, when we broke up, Eurogliders was right in the thick of it, and we could have just ended it all there, but we knew that we just loved working together so much that we had to try and work it out, so we did.
Oh, that's great. That's really inspiring. You're doing this tour at the moment. What can people expect to see if they come along?
Yeah, look, we've been playing now since last September, and the audiences are just amazing. I find, we both do, that the audiences are far more animated now than they were back in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
People are bringing their kids, they're bringing their parents. And so you look out into the audience, and I remember one up in Toowoomba a couple of weeks ago, there were people who were 80 years old. It's just a wide range of people, and they're just having fun. They just immediately come up the front, they start singing, they start dancing as if it was the 80s, and it's the most amazing experience, I have to say.
Mm. Well, I'm glad you're still enjoying it. That's the main thing.
It's actually got to the stage now where we realise that whether it's Queensland or Victoria, or like working on Saturday at Blacktown Workers this weekend, we know that the audience are going to have a great time. Eurogliders has always been a very good band and a fun band, and I think people really get involved with that.
Yeah, all right. Thank you, Bernie.
Thank you, Katrina. It's been a pleasure.
That's all right. It's Bernie Lynch from Eurogliders. They're playing at Blacktown Workers Club on Saturday, August 2nd, and at Heathcote Hotel on Sunday, August 3rd. And from Eurogliders, we have to play it, I think, now. This is Heaven on Hope 103.2.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.